This is Tracing Architecture, and I'm one of your hosts, Sean Swisher. Today's episode is brought to you in part by AIA Phoenix Metro. For today's episode, we're starting a new series highlighting the amazing designers we have here in Arizona, and we're starting off with Rick Joy. Back in December, I sat down with Rick, founding principal of the Tucson-based and renowned studio Rick Joy. We met in his studio in the Barrio Viejo to talk about his career and what led him to start his own firm almost 30 years ago, and dive into how he approaches the design process in his office. Let's listen to that conversation now. Rick, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So let's just get right into it. I've been looking into a lot of your history and your career, and you grew up on the East Coast, and you originally went to music school, and you played professionally as a drummer. So what led you to Tucson, and what led you to a career in architecture?
Well, it's a little complicated in that I spent a lot of time in my youth. My father was a printer. He would bring big rolls of white paper into the house, and I would draw underground cities in section. Didn't even really know what that was. I was like five. And my mother's looking for them right now. I want them bad.
Yeah.
She doesn't know where they are. But when I graduated from high school, they did an exit interview with all the students, and they said that I would be – well, first they said, Rick, your IQ is the highest we've ever seen in the school, and your grades are the lowest we've ever seen in the school. And so – but in the interview, they said, well, we've done some research, and we want to tell you that we think you'd be very good at either air traffic controlling or architecture. Which is fascinating because once you start doing projects all over the world and stuff, you're like more like an air traffic controller.
They're not that different.
No. And so I got very good at playing drums and started in the symphony, timpani and all that stuff, and xylophone, marimbas, and then started playing some jazz, and then started playing really soul and rock and roll and funk. And did that for a long time, did it till I was almost 28 and decided that I really didn't want to keep doing that. It was right when they started changing the music venues. I was playing in a place for 2 years. I only set up my drums once in Virginia Beach, and it was really great. It was like a 13-piece band like Earth, Wind, and Fire, and we were all originals. And I was the only white guy and the only guy under 30. And they kept me busy for 2 years, and then they started changing the venues to have like four bands at night. And so I was making more money than I make as an architect playing music. Now it's just really good. But I just said, you know, I'm going to go back and look at my interest in architecture. And I just took a physics course. I did really well in it in Portland, Maine, and started looking for schools. And back then, I mean, you have no idea what this is like at your age, but there was no internet. So you had to call the universities around. And I had a friend in Tucson, so I tried the U of A. And then they mail you a printed catalog with all the curriculum and stuff. And when I got mine, I was putting wood in my wood stove. It was freezing cold in the middle of the winter in Portland, Maine. And it came, and I opened it, and it was a sunset and a saguaro on the cover.
Tucson sounded pretty good.
Yeah. And so I called my friend, and I said, hey, let me put your gas bill in my name. And I did. And for the 7 months or so, I got myself in-state tuition by doing that.
That's a good trick.
Yeah.
I like that.
Pass it around because it's pretty easy. And the school was pretty great. The dean was Ron Gorley, who was one of Gropius's close friends, and very elegant man and an exceptional teacher. Was teaching at the GSD for a long time. And he came out here for the weather, for health and stuff. And I just happened to have my desk right outside his office for the first 3 years. Almost 3.5 years I was right outside his office. Yeah. And he would just come by. I was older than everybody else. And we'd talk. And I just learned so much. And then I just decided to stay. Will gave me a job for 3 years on the Phoenix Central Library and started my own thing.
So I'm curious with the music connection, because I feel like that's always something that people talk about, the connection of music and architecture. Was there anything there for you? Like, did you see the same sort of patterns or the things that intrigued you about the structure of music and the creativity of music that brought you into architecture? Or are these just two different parts of your brain?
No, that's very similar, because the way I design and teach people in the office, and they reteach me later, is through a narrative process where it's almost like writing a song. as a drummer, you know, you're thinking about the groove and the atmosphere of the song and putting that down. And all my long experiences and strong relationship with nature, it just came all together. And it's music in that way, the narrative way, rather than staccato rhythms and column grids and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not math, it's atmosphere.
It's that space, that liminal space that isn't even truly describable, but you create something beyond the sort of sum of its parts.
And then you have to learn how to describe it because, you know, clients want to know what you're doing, what you're up to, and, you know, spend enough time in the world and been coached by so many people. But Palasma's famous quote is that it should be more about the verb than the noun. The act of looking through a window or stepping through a threshold versus the cool door or window, or there's time for that later, but you really think about the purpose of what that window is. And I show a great shot in one of my lectures that shows the unit next door from here where the south sun is coming in, and it's just side light.
Yes, I know exactly the picture you're talking about.
It's side light. I show a shot of the Milk Maiden by Vermeer just before it, and it's meaningful. It's not that hard to do as an architect, to put the window in the right place.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to cost the same if you move it over 5 feet and miss the sun, I mean, just how we think.
So here's a question for you about, you had mentioned you came right out of school and you worked with Will Bruder on the Phoenix Central Library.
3 days later.
That's incredible. And then 3 years later, you started your own office. And can you just walk us through a little bit that experience with Will and the Central Library? And then what made you start that firm so early on in your career?
Well, Will came down and there was a group studio with Ricardo Legarreta and Will Bruder and Lawrence Halperin. And it was pretty special. It changed my whole perspective on architecture. Believe it or not, I started out first three years doing POMO. the only magazine I got at the time was Fine Home Building, which is all about that stuff.
Right?
Of houses in New England are postmodern. And so I just kind of like kept going. I had little flags, a little ball on the top of the flagpole and on roofs of all my projects and stuff. And then I had that semester with Will and Legarreta, Lawrence Halperin, and it just changed my whole outlook on things. And it's when I started this feeling of, you know, it's just a lot more original and atmospheric and kind of conceptually thoughtful and trying to be giving with it more than just taking something I already know from a magazine and going for it.
Yeah.
And so what Will noticed in me is I had a great sketching ability, freehand sketching. I was Kirby Lockhart's TA for 4.5 years. Wasn't even in the program yet because it's the first year and then you have to try to get into the second year.
Oh, yeah.
But I was still his TA
in the first year.
Yeah. He noticed that and he was already starting to conceptualize on the Phoenix Central Library. And I did a bunch of sketches at my desk at school.
Wow.
For Will. And they're in the Oscar Ojeda book on single building series.
Yeah.
They're all in there.
Oh, the ones you did on your desk at Kapla. Are in that
a couple book. Of them are. Yeah. The rest were done in the studio up there.
Yeah.
I drew the tensegrity roof structure, Kirby Lockhart style, freehand, faster than Arup could do it on an AutoCAD. 3D. And so at the end of that, I mean, it was 3 years and I had a lot of energy. I still do. I live in Tucson. We just had a baby. And Will said, you can't stay in Tucson and do that. But I did and drove up to New River every Monday and Thursday, stayed overnight Tuesday and I mean, Monday night and Thursday nights and built a family home for myself and the kids on Wednesdays and weekends in 9 months.
That's a busy schedule.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, 3 hours at his studio and I was never late in 3 years. And once you've done that, I mean, I didn't know anyone that I would want to work for in Tucson.
Sure.
But I found a little place down the street here on Convent Avenue for a very low rent. And I just opened it, made a sign out front.
Just put up your shingle.
Yeah, I put up my shingle. I'd already been registered, so Rick Joy Architects. I even put the S on it back then. It was just me. And I called all my professors that I had made friends with, and I offered to do the CDs or help them design all their projects that they were doing on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And I just did that in my office. And believe it or not, I faked a female voice when someone called and I said, Rick Joy Architect. like that. Just a moment, I'll see if he's in.
And then get low when you answer the phone.
Hello, this is Rick. How can I help you? I actually did that.
How many years did you fake having a secretary?
I think a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
And then this project came up, the Convent Studios. And I was fortunate because I got Arizona Home of the Year for the Family House. And so there were a bunch of magazines laying on the table when this client walked in. Later, I asked him, why did you choose me? And he goes, well, your office is on the same street. You look pretty successful. And I like your last name.
Hey.
And then we just built this project. And he offered to let me build a studio for myself and paid for it. And
wow.
Then many years later, it came up for sale. Some circumstances just happened, and I got to buy it for like the, 75% off sale.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
What a steal.
So it's nice. It's seven buildings. It's like a campus. People walking around all the time.
Yeah.
Meeting with each other in different buildings. And I just had to start your own thing.
I'm sitting here in your conference room, one of the several rammed earth structures on this campus. And I wanted to bring in this Louis Kahn quote. So Louis Kahn once described architecture as starting with something unmeasurable, turning it into something measurable so it can be built so that it can then become unmeasurable again, that the experiences inside it can be unmeasurable. And I see that connection directly with your work all the time. And we were just talking about Yohani Palasma and Alvarado and a few others before we started this conversation. And I guess I'm just wondering how, through your design process, do you traverse that bridge between the unmeasurable and the measurable and make sure that those things come together through the built and natural environments?
I don't think of the term measurable or unmeasurable, but I have learned a lot from Louis Kahn. When I started my practice, I still hadn't been to any Louis Kahn buildings, but I went to the library and I learned how to draw.
The Exeter Library?
No.
The architecture library. Yeah, yeah.
I tell students to do that. If you can't afford to travel to Fort Worth, just go to the library and look at how he draws plans. But one of the things that I learned the most on this topic that you're talking about is that he preached pretty hard about bringing a lot of yourself into the project, making yourself interesting and interested in things and being conceptually insightful and giving. You don't just take post-it notes and line them up and make floor plans. You dream of the something else to offer.
Yeah.
Something even better. And that's the unmeasurable part, I think. It's something that you can describe. And before we were doing, digital renderings, it was just like, I describe it.
Yeah.
Narrative style to the clients. And then, wow, I didn't know it was going to be like that. Way more fun than doing 20 renderings for a house,
That's for sure.
And so I've listened to a lot of I only have three, but lectures that Louis Kahn gave, like Yale and places. And I learned so much from him.
Yeah. When you work with clients on, like, you're speaking to them, you're working through this narrative with them, is your tool, your media, like some paper and a pencil or a pen and talking with the client, and as you're narrating, you sketch, or are there other ways that you convey to the client?
I just talk it through. I've never been one to charrette with a client, like hold hands and hold the same pencil and try to sketch the house in front of them.
Yeah.
It's a lot more work than that.
Yeah.
And also, the old saying, don't let them see how the sausage is made kind of thing. Because it's messy for me. I'm all over the place until something clicks. And then
you got to bring it together to show them or describe it. Yeah. So in the last few years, you've talked a lot, and you mentioned it earlier, about how your office has grown in keeping this collaborative spirit inside the office. And you changed the studio's name not that long ago to sort of represent that idea. And I'm curious, what does collaboration look like in your office? Like, how do you work with your colleagues?
I kind of generally don't pay attention to the term collaborative. It's more, for me, it's more cooperative. Collaborations are different people with different ideas kind of doing their own thing together. Mm-hmm. And cooperation is a one world, kind of takes a village.
Yeah.
And that's how we do it. That came from a great discussion with a little article that Max Underwood wrote. And he helped me put those terms together. And it's, so it's cooperative.
Yeah.
It is a cooperative, really. What's really fun, and I sort of latched onto this early on, is that I hire people from other countries quite a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, currently we have someone from Morocco, South Africa, Austria, Iran, Sweden, Tunisia, a couple of people from Mexico, and Virginia.
You could be a model UN in your office.
Yeah. United Colors of Benetton Architects. But, you know, when we had the firm was large at one point with 37 people, mm-hmm. plus our lighting design and interiors firm. And so that was like 40 people. And we had 15 of them were from other countries.
That's amazing.
It's pretty fun. Lunchtime is always fun because it sounds like an international call center for like AT&T or something. Because they're all calling their families or friends and stuff in different languages. And so it really enriches things. You know, I had one of the funny stories, and a good one that described this really well, is that I was working with a young guy from Vietnam, Luat Duong. And I've had somebody from Vietnam now. We've had three. It's excellent. I'm trying to help him design and think about how to do a master bedroom, bathroom in a fancy house. Well, not so fancy back then, but I said, two sinks. And he's like, really, two sinks? He goes, Rick, you have to understand that I got a lot to learn on this because I used to have to run down to the river.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So there it is right there in a little, you know, nutshell, that the richness of different people coming from other countries is just really great.
Yeah. So it's a lot of, I mean, not only are you getting perspectives from people from all over the world that probably sort of enrich the way you think about the architecture, but then you're working directly with them. Like you even framed it as you were helping him solve this issue of the bathroom in the master suite. And so you're working hands-on with your employees and you're developing these ideas together with them to solve the problems for the client.
Yeah. And I quite often give the youngest and newest people in the office bathrooms to work on. It comes from my history because that's what Will put me on in the Phoenix Central Library. I designed those bathrooms.
Those are nice bathrooms.
Yeah. Another guy that we had, Bach from Vietnam too, I put him on the bathrooms at Princeton, and they were, I don't know, these things are amazing. They're stalls of marble.
Wow.
Carrara marble, and each stall in the women's room has their own private skylight.
That's nice. That's
it's
nice
pretty
touch.
Luxurious. And you know what? I just said, let's do something special for anyone who goes in there, and we had the opportunity, so we took the skylighted here.
The bathroom idea is interesting because there's just so many details in one small space. And like, not only is it about like maneuvering and details and privacy and all of that, it's just in about 50 square feet, you know, or maybe a few hundred square feet, but it's such a small bit that really you have to touch so many things in one spot.
Well, when we did the transit hall on five buildings at Princeton University, one of them was a transit hall. So I wanted, you know, it to be a very special place to hang out. And we moved it from on the master plan that they gave us to work from. It was just part of a big Wawa store, a mm-hmm. waiting room. And I said, I'm not putting the bathrooms in this. We're going to move this out, make a transit plaza between. We're going to put the bathrooms in the Wawa store. And so the first article came out. They interviewed some people from Princeton, the president and the campus architect, who you might know, Ron McCoy. And half the article was on my wife's lighting design at the sinks.
Just at the sinks in the restroom?
Yeah.
In the Wawa?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, she got more press than I did on that whole project. And they mentioned the transit hall and the plaza and the cafe and restaurant and stuff we did and all that. But some of the faculty and administration would go in there, put on their makeup on their way to work in the morning because the lighting was so perfect.
It's so lucky that you were able to put this transit hall around these restrooms so that people could experience those restrooms. That one lighting moment.
You have to go over to the Wawa.
Yeah.
Across the plaza, go in there. I don't want people sitting in a transit hall. I call it transit hall rather than train station because there's taxis and buses and all. And I don't want people just sitting there listening to the toilet flush. You know, it's only 1,000 square feet. So we won the day on that one.
The Princeton Transit Hall, so that brings me to another point about your office that I wanted to talk about, because your firm, the scale of your projects has been growing quite a bit in just the last couple decades, let's say maybe 15 years, where you've gone from these smaller homes to, you know, the resort that you just finished. I think it's called One and Only in
Nayarit. One and Only Mandarina. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Before that, we did the Mangiri in southern Utah. And then this project at Princeton. The Mandarina is huge. It's 178 standalone buildings.
So how are you with your firm? How are you managing to keep the same sort of focus when this scale grows on these projects? It just seems incredible because I've seen the renderings, at least. I've not been to Nayarit to go to this resort.
Well, you can look on our website. Those are photographs.
Those are photographs?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, two are renderings.
They look immaculate.
We have to go down and get a drone and go down and get the big restaurants that are on the cliffs.
Yeah.
You know, we had 35 people working on that. Different people doing different things. Four project managers and one more primary. And it was the same with Amagiri. I mean, we had never done a hotel before. Mm-hmm. And I enlisted Marwan and Wendell to help be part of the team because I just didn't, I only had 10 people at the time. They each had one or two. And that just made it so that it was more flexible and we could just all work together on it. And I think we had, at the end, over 120 people worked on that project over the 12 years it took to make it. Yeah. And it's a big jump. It's more, the dealings with those kind of projects are more difficult with the people, you know, the ownership, the managers of the money of the, in Mexico, it went from being a private family to a public company. Mm-hmm. So all the people changed like four times.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was funny. There was a point when the guy was pointing me in the, almost hitting me in the chest with his pointer finger. And he's going like, Rick, you have to learn how to read the site better. And I'm and I'm like, well, you know, I hate to tell you this, but I'm teaching at the Harvard GSD right now, and that's my topic. So I think I know how to do some of this stuff.
I think so.
And so the, you know, Amangiri was built around this kind of notion of being insightful and giving a very up close and personal privileged experience to be up in that kind of rock formations.
Yeah.
When we generally just drive fast past them to get from LA to Denver or whatever. And Mandarina was how to live in the jungle and just be, again, up close and personal with jungle plants and the ocean and the wildlife there. And so the standalone buildings are 115 rooms and half are tree houses and half are grounded in the jungle. Plus horse stables and polo fields and kids clubs and a Ricky Oliveira restaurant and a main restaurant for breakfast and stuff. It's just beach clubs and a jetty to nourish the beach and make it bigger and stuff. It's just like on and on. And we did all the interiors, all the collateral, and all the lighting design for every building on that.
Wow. How long have you been working on that project?
That was an 8-year one.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's a beast. That's a lot of work. And are you just kind of like taking, you know, bite-sized chunks of this at a time to work through this huge project or like master planning?
No, I'm doing like sit down and discuss like the magic that we're going to be searching for. And we have to fit this number of rooms in and the site's too steep. So let's just make tree houses. It took a minute to say that. And then the grounded ones are just on a more, a little bit more flat-ish on the edge of the cliffs and stuff. And it just gave the hotelier a great opportunity to just mix it up and have people choose which kind they wanted. And then currently it's the number one luxury resort project in the world. Amagiri was for 8 years in different categories. Condé Nast. Everyone's raving about Enrique Oliveira's restaurant. It's on a cliff and it's a sexy nightclub. Sexiest one in Mexico for sure. Now that it's over, we started to sit up straight again. You know, we all shrugged over and
take a breath
and working our asses off. And the new owners and different people were changing their minds on stuff for the 5 years it took to get it and start it in the ground. But it's done and it looks fantastic. And for a whole building culture that really rarely looks at the plans, it came out perfect.
That, I mean, from everything I've seen so far, it seems like an incredible place. All of the little buildings seem like these real testaments to the way you've described your architecture, I've heard you describe it before, and I'll paraphrase as far as like, you're going to provide people an opportunity to connect to nature. Like that's what your architecture is going to do. Yeah. And I mean, it seems quite easy in at least like how you connect them to nature when you've got this abundance of nature in this beautiful place like Nayarit, but with 178 buildings and all these different building types and different ways it's touching the earth, I bet that was just sort of an incredible experience of figuring out how you would connect them to nature.
Yeah. I mean, the structure of everything was pretty intense.
Yeah.
Three different structural engineers and two different Mexican architecture firms, landscape architects. But we did everything. We did the master plan. We designed the details of the roads and where the roads go. And we went and remeasured the survey where the trees were located and had to move rooms around a little bit.
Set them aside, one palm tree or another.
Yeah. And the whole nature thing just comes naturally to me now because when I was a child, we were financially challenged. I'm going to just put it that way. There was no money for anything. Yeah. And so when there was a time to celebrate or spend time together and have fun, we just went out to nature, either the beach or the lake or fishing or a picnic in the forest or something like that. And I just, it made me believe that nature is the true luxury. I mean, you can have a gilded faucet or a tree. We're doing a project in Austin right now where every room has its own heritage live oak tree. Every room.
That sounds... You're saying inside the room or a view?
No, outside the view.
Okay.
It feels like it's inside. Much like the Napa house that we did for Coppola. You know, and people say that to me. They say, you know, I say, well, how's it going? And you hired me, so there must have been some reason. And they say, yeah, we believe you were going to bring nature into our lives. Yeah. That's what I do. And that's what we're a teaching firm. So I teach that stuff and then they teach it back to me and it's fun.
I think about the gentleman you had said who had to wash his hands down at the river in Vietnam. That seems like one of those opportunities of them sharing something back to you and probably something you'll put in the back of your head and think of later.
Yep.
Yeah. So I've got another question about your office because I think you're about to hit your 30th anniversary, like 2023.
Yeah, September. Yeah. As a registered architect.
So the big question I have then is, over the last few years have been probably quite crazy, not just with this project that you just wrapped up that took 8 years or what have you, but the last 2.5, 3 years with COVID. And I'm curious what you're taking out of that experience, because I think that time has shaped everybody a little bit differently, shaped every firm a little bit differently. What do you feel like Studio Rick Joy is taking out of COVID and moving into the future with?
Well, I mean, we took a beating like most architects did. I think we lost $500 million worth of budgets in March when COVID started. But we had still some resources left in various ways, and we didn't lay off anyone. And we didn't cut salaries or anything like that. Everyone kept busy because we had enough, just barely enough for everyone to work on. When COVID hit, a lot of the people from other countries were already starting to think about at their age having babies and stuff. And if you're from Chile, you just want to have that at home because you're going to have your family and you're going to have maids, live-in maids, even if you're just right out of school with a small salary, or from Italy and go back and parents help you teach you how to do all this stuff. So a lot of people fled and went back. They want to sit in Tucson in a small apartment with COVID. And that helped us quite a lot. But we had two people go through during COVID family leave and make babies and stuff. And once we sort of suggested that everyone get the vaccine and boosters and stuff, then we just started coming back into the studio. And right now, we just are really diligent in monitoring people. People are getting colds right now.
Yeah.
Which is scary after, you know, and we still have COVID.
Yeah, yeah.
My communications director is out with a cold because she spent Thanksgiving with a family, had two little kids in preschool. And it just happens, you know.
Yeah,
it's just gonna.
It's true.
But we're all in the office. And if you feel like you're getting a cold or something, you stay home. But with this compound that we have here with the seven different buildings, a young man from Morocco, Canada, he stayed home for a few days and then he worked in one of these units by himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so he could be on the server. And
so do you feel like you guys got a lot of flexibility in through that whole process, like just being able to operate wherever people needed to be and be able to still carry out the projects at the same level, but be a little bit more nimble?
Yeah. And, you know, I don't have the right brain power for people working from home. You know, it's just, you never know. And when I was working at home, and part of it is because there's a TV and there's CNN and there's a news, and I live just up the street from Time Market, and let's go get a coffee and slice of pizza later, and just walk around the neighborhood and make phone calls. And it's not the same as just coming in here and being with everyone.
Especially for an office that, as you mentioned, so cooperative, so narrative-based, yeah. I could envision being physically apart, being very difficult to share those same moments, share that communication.
We're a real team. And again, it's a teaching firm as well as a doing firm. I haven't done it in a while, but I used to just go up to somebody in the main office and say, okay, turn off your monitor. Don't look at your watch or your phone. What time is it?
How often would they get it right?
Quite a lot, actually, because that room has a skylight at the end, and you can tell it's when it's 12:30, the whole light wall ignites, you know. And but just by tracing where the sun is and in the room and outside in the courtyard, it's what we have to do as architects. We have to know about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing that we do a lot is that you have to have a sketch pad, draw to scale, because I can still, at my age, draw to eighth scale and quarter scale freehand without a scale. You do it enough, you just get it in your head. You know how things work. But, you know, with AutoCAD and Revit, and it's none of it's to scale.
It's true.
And that drove me crazy. I only did one set of drawings in AutoCAD for that cabin right there, Greer, that model. And I didn't start out very well because I wanted to cross the corners. Remember the old drawings?
How
just cross the corner, make it look more square and all that kind of. And Andy Tanucci in my office came over. He goes, "What are you doing?" And he told me about the concept of snap to points and all that stuff. And I finally got it. But I actually thought for a day that I was going to actually print the prints and go in and draw the little hatch marks on the corners freehand.
Well, it would have looked better than the AutoCAD hatches.
I know. But I don't know. I still have a new office for myself with a big drawing table, and I get more done on that than I do, you know.
On a computer.
On a computer, so. And when I was in school, computers were rolled around on carts. There was I don't know what you call them, the cards.
You know. The, like, punch cards?
Punch cards.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. That's kind of, in a nutshell, how the firm works. And
yeah.
How I like to do things.
So what are you guys looking forward to in the future? I mean, just before we started, you had mentioned you have a few interesting projects coming up, but whether it's projects or other things, like what are you looking forward to in the next few years?
During this whole COVID thing, what was interesting is we started getting more calls for small houses, you know, back to the Desert Works level kind of small houses. So we're doing one in Greer, Arizona, we're doing one in way north in Minnesota, and one in Yucca Valley, and one in Austin, Texas, right in the city, in the forest in the middle of the city. People are really happy because, you know, you get somebody, get four people to go work on a mixed-use development project in Austin, Texas, and they get stuck working on a parking garage when they just got out of school and they were looking at Desert Works the whole time. Sure, they get to live and work in some of our projects, but they're much happier working on these small projects. And And so, but we're getting calls to move around a lot now. We're doing a couple of houses down in Cabo and probably another one in Mexico City, or Todos Santos. We're talking to those people, and St. Bart's in the Bahamas. Everybody wants to go to the Bahamas.
Yeah.
And St. Bart's. St. Bart's is another small hotel.
Yeah.
Maybe a 20-room hotel right on the main beach.
Those are a lot of exciting projects.
They're pretty fun. It's an ordeal to fly to places like St. Bart's and the Bahamas. It was just because my plane is still in the showroom. It's in the showroom right now. But, you know, it's pretty dreamy. I mean, I'll show you a picture when we're finished of the turquoise water in the Bahamas from last week.
If this was a visual podcast, I'm sure people would love to see that.
Yeah. Well, just look up the Bahamas from the air and you'll see just full turquoise waters and waist deep swimming and all that stuff. It's great. Other things we're doing is, well, we just had an office sort of Thanksgiving party at my house, and we're doing the holiday party at the Augustine Kitchen at the Mercado. Mm-hmm. And then I'm doing a workshop with Peter Stutchbury from Australia in Costa Rica in January. That should be fun. And at the somewhere around the first of the year, I'm going to start giving the whole office drum lessons.
Nice. During the workday?
Maybe at lunch.
There you go. Lunchtime. Okay.
It doesn't take too very long to do the exercises at first, because it's, you know, it's right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left. And make sure that you can't tell the difference between the sound of either one. And I just bought a Questlove drum set.
Nice.
A Ludwig Questlove drum set. It's going to go upstairs here. And so with these big, thick walls, I mean, people can just come over and practice at night and stuff. I bought a drum pad and sticks for each person. And I'm going to line them up and I'm going to start teaching. And the name of the course is Your Brain on Drums.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And it's important. It helped me out a lot. It's really fresh. And I just played again yesterday, Sunday. And that kind of eye-hand coordination goes well with, like, Yohani's book, The Thinking Hand, and all that stuff. And that's kind of some of the fun stuff we do. In September, well, we have a lot of parties. We call them meetings.
Mm-hmm.
M-E-A-T-I-N-G. And I have an El Camino, and we put, you know, ice and beer in the back and nice. Pellegrino and stuff and pull it into the yard. We have two big grills, one for meat, one for veggies, with two sinks next to it, with one for meat and one for veggies, and friends that are DJs and stuff. And one of my guys is a DJ too.
Nice.
And we just have a good time together.
Well, it sounds like you guys have a lot of fun things coming up in the next year. Sounds like a good time over at Studio Rick Joy.
Yeah, I've already noticed them starting to sort of squabble about who gets to go to the Bahamas next.
Yeah, those are good squabbles to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a pilot on a single engine Piper Cub from Georgetown to the island.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't have any shoes on. His arm was out the window. And it was pretty fascinating.
Well, with that, we will end everybody with the vision of that pilot, the shoeless pilot flying over the ocean. Thank you very much for your time today, Rick.
Yep. Again, my pleasure.
That's it for today's episode. We'd like to thank AIA Phoenix Metro again for their support. We'd also like to thank Rick Joy for the insightful conversation and his team for hosting us. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at tracingarchitecture@gmail.com. You can listen to this episode and more on our website, tracingarchitecture.org, or downloading from Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever podcasts can be found.